Welcome to the podcast from Cambridge University Medical Education Group, or QMEG for short. This is a podcast from the University of Cambridge Clinical School, focusing on medical education. We will be touching on a range of topics that medical educators are dealing with. I'm your host, Cheryl France, head of QMEG. Today, I would like to introduce Dr. Roger Petter, Deputy Lead, Student Welfare. Roger is also a GP that works for Doctors for Doctors. We're going to be talking about the impact of COVID on health professionals and how we can support them better and ensure that more people want to continue in the medical field. Please note that this episode contains a discussion about suicide and mental health, which some listeners may find distressing. Welcome, Roger. It's wonderful to have you here today.
Thank you very much indeed, Cheryl, for your welcome and for your kind invitation to take part in this.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to our discussion today, I have to say. I think it would be great if you could just start out by introducing yourself, talk about your background and the two roles that you have.
Lovely, thank you. So, yes, my background is in general practice. I've been a GP partner for over 25 years and I've been a GP trainer for 20 years. So I've always been involved in medical education and I still do quite a bit of medical student teaching. But my main involvement now is with welfare support, and I provide this both for medical students and also for qualified doctors. So the medical student support is through my role as Deputy Lead for Student Welfare at the University of Cambridge School of Clinical Medicine. And we support medical students with any welfare, personal or health problems. And that will, of course, include physical health, poor mental health and the impact of COVID. And what we tend to do is we assess the whatever the problem may be, but particularly the impact of that on the students' training, their placements, their exams, making up time off that they've needed. So any impact on their course and their training, but potentially even their ability to become a doctor.
Well, that's quite interesting. It is quite a varied role. We did speak to Fiona Cook about it as well, and she told us a bit about it, and it sounded there's a lot to deal with.
There is. And it's very much a case of teamwork and liaising with colleagues, and that's part of the enjoyment of it. We work well as a team with the collective aim of supporting our students as well as we can.
And that's one thing that really has come across, is that there is a lot of support for students, and I think that's really reassuring. Particularly as a student who may be considering medicine, thinking, oh, goodness, there's a lot to the course. Am I able? But knowing that there's support in place, that if there is a difficult time, they will have individuals they can speak to or resources that they can tap into, which
yes.
I think is fantastic.
And that's something we pride ourselves on. Training to be a doctor is busy, tough and stressful. And however resilient you are, it's inevitable that people will have ups and downs, and other things unpredictably may occur along the way, either health problems or things like bereavements. And whatever it is, our aim is to support students.
That's fantastic. And it has come across really well. So I think that's wonderful. And I think the other role that we'd like to talk to you about today is the fact that it doesn't stop once you become a doctor. There are opportunities to still have that support moving forward. So that's your other role. Can you
yes.
tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So I provide welfare support, again, as part of a team for doctors after qualification. And this is as part of what's called the Doctors for Doctors service at Haddon Brookes. And essentially, it's professional wellbeing and clinicians support. And again, doctors can come to us with absolutely anything that they want to talk about. We see both consultants and also doctors in training. There are six of us currently working for the Doctors for Doctors service. We all have a background in general practice. And that's important to the way the service works because it means that we understand the system and the pressures and the impact of COVID. But because we're not direct hospital colleagues of the doctors that we're seeing, we're interested and involved, but we're not their colleagues, we're not people who will be doing their appraisals or involved with their career pathway or writing references for them or anything of that sort. And the aim is that that will then create an environment where they feel that they can come and seek confidential support and advice.
That's really interesting. So is there a separate mechanisms for GPs, and is this available in other parts of the UK, or is this specific to Adam Brooks Hospital, as you referred?
So the Doctors for Doctors service, as far as I'm aware, started here at Adam Brooks with one of my colleagues, Dr. Susie Hunt. There are moves to try and roll it out elsewhere, and also to try and extend it. It's already been extended to offer support for physiotherapists, and looking also into maybe offering similar support for nurses as well. So I think it is something that will inevitably roll out further, because it has certainly proved its worth in terms of helping to support the workforce. And that in turn, of course, means that we can give as good a service as we can for patients, which is what we're all here for.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's good to hear that it's for allied health professionals as well as the medical doctors.
So yes, that's all work in progress, which I think over a period of time will roll out and extend.
Brilliant. That is brilliant. So in terms of that, I think it would be interesting to understand more about some of the doctors that may come to you with that service and how it works in practice. Can you just tell us practically, how does that service work?
Yes, so Dr. Hunt, who heads the service, will periodically send emails to all the Adam Brooks doctors saying that the service is here, that we're available. We then wait for doctors to contact the service, and then one of us will make contact by email and arrange either face-to-face or more commonly Zoom meetings to support the doctors. At the first meeting, we usually have very little idea about what it is they want to talk about. But in a way, that's a bit like being a GP, where you don't know who's going to walk through your consulting room door next. And that's part of the stimulation and the enjoyment of it. It keeps you on your toes. And hopefully, whatever people bring to us, we can help them with. Very often, of course, we may not have the answers immediately, and we may need to seek advice from elsewhere, exactly as we would in our role as GPs. We don't pretend to have all the answers, but we can guide, signpost, seek advice from elsewhere if we need to.
And I think that is helpful. And it's the fact, as you said, that you understand the system, you understand what it's like to be a doctor. So having somebody that they can come and speak to is really, really helpful, or I can imagine it can be very helpful for them. So prior to coming today, I was trying to do some research myself and try to understand some of the impacts. And I understand from the literature that doctors have particular issues with suicide rates that could be between 2 and 4 times higher than those of other professional groups. And that the culture for dentistry and medicine is generally not supportive. Is that what you found? And are there resources available to combat this?
That's a really good question, and also highlights a really important tragic point. Obviously, every suicide is an absolute tragedy, and as well as the devastating effect on families and friends and colleagues, there are huge circles of people affected by every suicide. It's estimated maybe 150 people affected by each suicide, but probably more for health professionals because of the impact on colleagues and patients as well. In terms of numbers of doctors, certainly the figures I have seen suggest that it may be the rate of suicide may be between 2 and 5 times that of the general population. I haven't seen figures comparing with other professional groups, but certainly with the general population between 2 and 5 times. And this seems to be a particular issue for GPs, which may reflect working lifestyle, support available, lots of factors probably there. The culture itself, I think, is changing for the better, thankfully. In the past, there probably has been a feeling that doctors need to battle on, because if they presented with poor mental health, it might be perceived as a sign of weakness, or they may feel that they'd be poorly understood. I think stigma still is, sadly, an issue. But again, I think that is changing. I think some doctors in the past have worried that it might affect their career progression. And another big issue, which I find with medical students as well as with qualified doctors, is that many people feel that having poor mental health might lead to a fitness to practice investigation, which is not necessarily the case. And that's something we can maybe come back to, if you like.
Actually, we can talk about that now, because I think that would be really helpful to understand, what does it mean, this fitness to practice? Why is that a concern? Why wouldn't somebody come and tell you there's an issue?
Yes. So it partly comes down to an understanding of exactly what fitness to practice is. So fitness to practice is something that all medical students and doctors should abide by. And it's really about the qualities that make a good doctor and someone who acts with integrity. So it'll involve things like making patient care your first concern, being competent, keeping up to date, maintaining good relationships both with colleagues and with patients, and acting honestly and acting within the law. Now, health problems, of course, could impact on those. Any health problem could impact on those. It's possible that health could lead someone to act with inappropriate behaviour, or to be dishonest, or to be persistently unreliable. But poor mental health is different. It doesn't automatically mean that you're not fit to practice with all those qualities we've spoken about. Health problems could lead to fitness to practice problems, but providing a doctor has got insight into their problem and they take appropriate action if their health is impacting their behaviour or their performance, and that would involve seeking help when they need to and complying with treatment, and maybe if they're not well enough to work, informing the relevant people. So if a doctor, whether it's with physical health or mental health problems, acts appropriately, then it would not be considered a fitness to practice issue.
I think that's really helpful to describe that, because we all have good days and bad days, no matter what it is. But when your health has had an impact in one way or another, how we deal with that is really important. So, you know, if I'm having a bad day because I'm concerned about my health for some reason, if you're then addressing a patient and are rude or inappropriately speak to them because of that, that's not okay. However, you could do that without being unwell.
Yes, exactly.
And that's the fitness to practice issue. But recognizing the need to seek help is just as important,
yes.
I imagine.
And it's often repeated patterns of behaviour that might be perceived as being a problem. I think one difficulty with poor mental health is that that can affect things like insight. And some people with poor mental health may not comply with their treatments. And of course, that could in turn impact on the care that they can give their patients. But the message that I would strongly give to both medical students and doctors is that having poor mental health doesn't automatically mean that you are subject to fitness to practice investigations. And from a professionalism point of view, if you are worried about your health, it's much more important to seek help so that you can get treatments and therefore look after your patients properly than stick your head in the sand and try and ignore the issue and then potentially lead to far bigger problems further down the line.
Well, absolutely. And what started this conversation, which is the sad fact that suicide rates are high and that is a tragedy. So let's not get to that point anyway. So it's the fact of seeking help is really important on so many levels. So I think that's a really useful message to get across. And also you touched on the fact that there is this stigma, but there is a pattern of change now. People are starting to see that mental health is an issue that needs to be addressed and that we can talk about it. We don't have to brush things under the carpet,
yes.
The saying goes.
Absolutely. I think people are far more ready to talk about their own mental health and that of others than maybe they used to be. And that's followed on from a whole series of things. It's partly a cultural change. I think there have been a number of significant changes in terms of reports and things of that sort. So in the past, sadly, there were a number of student suicides at Bristol University. And in 2019, that led to the University Mental Health Charter. That was a big, important step. There have been a number of reports on responding to the death of a medical colleague over recent years. And I think just changing attitudes to mental health and an increased awareness and willingness of people to talk about it has helped. One thing, though, that for those of us who are involved in supporting students and doctors with poor mental health, one thing that is a big issue is that numbers suggest that maybe only about a third of people who commit suicide were previously known to mental health services. So that leaves a big majority who commit suicide who were not previously known about. And trying to reach those people and offer them support and advice before it's too late is a really big challenge for us all.
That is a challenge and something that we need to tackle on a global scale, potentially, rather than in pockets. But it's encouraging to know that we do have pockets of support here. But I think, as you say, that is a staggering number, really, and yes. Sad that we're not able to reach those. So if it's okay with you, I think I want to kind of lead on to the next question, which is thinking about this pandemic. That really highlighted the impact of caring for so many ill individuals and the long hours that medical professionals were giving to patients at such a crucial time. So many of us recall those images of busy hospitals and doctors and nurses providing the best care at a really, really difficult time. We also have seen interviews with healthcare professionals talking about being exhausted. And there's a real concern that individuals may feel burned out. I think the last thing that we want is for all of these highly trained health professionals, our doctors, our nurses, our allied healthcare professionals that think, I'm tired. I don't want to do this job anymore. How do we try to support them to say, you know what, we understand that you are tired and you do provide excellent care and service. How do we keep them?
Yes, it's incredibly hard. And burnout is a real issue. It's a real concern for everyone involved in health service provision. Even before COVID, to be honest, it's always been there as an issue for all doctors and other, you know, allied health professionals. Even before COVID, in 2018, the BMA did a survey and they estimated at that time that about 80% of doctors were at risk. And as you say, the impact of COVID has multiplied the stresses that doctors are under multiple fold. I think people don't always understand exactly what burnout is. It's more than just feeling exhausted. It's really a mental and emotional exhaustion secondary to work. And the knock-on effects really impact on the care that people are able to give to their patients. So people will typically feel emotionally depleted, overworked, too many demands on them. They often can feel quite depersonalized, so they may lose their empathy for their patients or feel negative or detached. And clearly that's not good for anyone. And very often a reduced sense of achievement and success. And all of that means that people can disengage professionally and, as you allude to, consider retiring early or giving up or changing their career. I think in terms of the support, it's very difficult. I mean, clearly everyone needs proper support, and doctors and other health professionals need colleagues who are able to make good assessments and provide support in a non-judgmental way, because that will help people to feel better able to present with their problems. I think it's so important to have a culture where people feel that they can present and that it won't automatically lead to a change or potential end of their career. In terms of the support that is available, it'll depend very much on the circumstances, what the particular issues are for that doctor, and that's why it's so important that they can speak to someone who understands and knows what support services may be available. So it may be a case of them needing time off or work adjustments. They may well need specific treatment for health problems, including poor mental health. Medical defense organizations or the BMA may often give support for things like patient complaints, because that's one of the things that can tip people over into burnout. Burnout can result, obviously, from work issues, often personal factors. Some personality types are more prone to burnout. Some people are less well supported in their home life. But patient factors can often be an issue. High expectations, or I've certainly seen doctors who have been just coping and have then been tipped over into burnout because a patient has made a complaint against them, and that's a devastating thing to happen. So support in terms of complaints is really important. Often it may result from poor team dynamics, and so things like mediation between colleagues, all trusts will provide mediation and work on teamwork when that is required.
Can I just ask you a few questions of some of what you've just talked about? So the BMA, or British Medical Association, I think that's interesting that they had a study before the pandemic and already these issues were coming up as a concern. And I think it's useful that you've highlighted the fact that burnout is not just the job. There will be other things that are happening in a person's life to feel the overwhelming pressures of work. Patient complaints being one, it's not to say that patients shouldn't complain, because sometimes they're really important faults, or even just something happened on a day, and those issues are really important to bring to the fore. So I would say that we shouldn't say that that's a bad thing. Sometimes they are unfounded. It's somebody who's also had a bad day and just throws in a complaint, doesn't think about it. So I want to just highlight that patient complaints, there is a mechanism for that, and they are important for a reason. But the individual who has that complaint, it's good that they could be supported to deal with that. And I'm pleased that you brought that out as well, that the British Medical Association and trusts have mechanisms in place to support those issues when they come up.
Yes, and the medical defence organisations as well, of course.
Yes, of course. So there are areas in which doctors can be supported. So I think that's really important to bring out as well. But going back to this burnout, it can come from so many mechanisms. And it's good that you highlighted colleagues as well, and the fact that sometimes there's mediation needed within the workplace. And so there's lots of factors that can lead to an individual feeling stressed at work and how they may come about in getting that support.
Yes, and I think within the workplace, other things that are important is having a supportive leadership, because that can create a good sense of teamwork so that doctors don't feel that they're working in isolation. That can be really demoralizing. And trying to create a work ethos where people feel that they can seek help and that they will be taken seriously and that support is accessible and that people are aware of what support is available. Because I think a lot of doctors who are feeling stressed or potentially burnt out as well don't realise the huge level of support that is available, and that may hinder them coming forward. And obviously the aim always is that people should seek help before it's too late, before they have poor mental health, before they feel burnt out. Very often these issues can be tackled before it's too late.
And I think you've highlighted that today. And I think that's really important that we do talk about that, that there are areas where people can get support. I go back to that statistic that only a third of individuals who attempted or committed suicide had actually sought any sort of support. So clearly, there is a need to highlight the support mechanisms and the fact that people will be taken seriously and helped. I think that's really important that we go back to that. And it goes back to don't allow that stigma to be there. It's not going to hurt fitness to practice. If anything, we're all there to support one another and to ensure that individuals get what they need at the time that they need it. And I think that's a really important message. I may have just stolen your thunder on this one. To me, it's been really interesting to chat to you today and to learn more about supporting our medical professionals, helping to think about burnout and how not to get to that position. Particularly, we talked about the pandemic, but actually it's been an issue since way before the pandemic. So I think that's interesting to highlight as well. Sometimes we put too much on the pandemic, and maybe that's not the right way to address these things. From your perspective, what should listeners take away from today? What would be your top points that you think listeners should take away?
Yes, that's a very good question. I mean, there are all sorts of things that we, for other things we could have spoken about and haven't. But I think the important things are to realize that mental health, poor mental health, is very common amongst the medical workforce. So if this is something that an individual feels affects them, they shouldn't feel alone or isolated, or that the people they seek help from are not familiar with those problems. As we've said, poor mental health is not the same as a fitness to practice issue. There could be an overlap, but it's not an automatic link. So hopefully that worry wouldn't put people off seeking help. So I think it's very important that people realise that there are lots and lots of different sources of support available. There are many things we haven't had time to touch on, things like occupational health services, which are really important, both local and national services. There's all sorts of different things. And for any one individual who has poor mental health, there will be the right source of help. Finding that is not always straightforward. And so speaking to someone like myself or colleagues who is aware of the spectrum of what's on offer may be wise, so that a doctor or a medical student or other health professionals can try and find what's right for them. And then I think the other really important take-home message is that our own health has to be a number one priority, because if we're not well, then we can't look after our own patients. And just very simple general things are so important. So making sure that we're eating and drinking well, careful about our alcohol intake, trying to get some sleep, getting fresh air and exercise, maintaining our interests, thinking really carefully about how we use our time off. And one of the big impacts of COVID has been that a lot of people have been working from home, and maintaining boundaries at home between work and home can be so difficult but so important. So looking after yourself as number one, because then you can look after the others, is important. I think of that a bit like on an aeroplane where they say, put on your own oxygen mask before helping those next to you. And it's so true.
That is a really good analogy. It is true. A lot of people are not good about looking after themselves first. And you're right, the boundaries have been blurred with more people working from home. So I think that's a really important message, is to look after yourself. Another message that we've often come back to is be kind to yourself and others. And we're not always doing that. So I think your message is really helpful. And also the fact that there is the right help for each individual out there.
There is.
Don't be afraid to ask for it. Yeah, I think that's really helpful. Thank you so much. And thank you for being with us today. It's been really interesting to talk to you and to learn more about your different roles. So thank you, Dr. Roger Petter. We really appreciate you being here today. It's been such an interesting conversation.
Thank you, Cheryl. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. So if listeners are interested in learning more about student welfare and supporting the doctors of our future, just as Roger's described today, and in thinking through from students all the way through to the health professionals, please contact us via the QMEG website. You will also find other podcasts on the QMEG website. Go to www.cumeg.cam.ac.uk or look for us wherever you get your podcasts. We are grateful to you, our listeners. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedules to listen to us today. If you would like to hear more from our series, please like and subscribe to our podcast. What do you do when your organization needs to change but there's resistance? How can evaluation help with that? Join us next week, where we'll be discussing this with Dr. Rika Hoffman. We look forward to you joining us next time.